listening to the Northern Football Podcast with Peter Galindo and Thomas Neff.
Yes, it's episode 67 of the Northern Football Podcast. I'm Peter Galindo, joined by Alexander Gonge-Ruzic. No Thomas Neff again due to more life commitments, but he'll be back next week. How are things out west, good sir?
Yes, much less complicated than our poor boy over there, Thomas Neff, but hopefully things are going well for him. But here it's nice. It's starting to be sunny again. It's chill. It's shaping up to be a good summer. And I mean, big news out of Vancouver today in the soccer scene, and there's going to be a lot more soccer coming to town. So super, super good times out here on the West Coast.
That's an excellent tease. We will get into that very, very soon. Just before we do, a reminder to subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss any episodes. If you're an Apple or Spotify user, leave us a rating and drop a review on Apple specifically while you're at it. So as AGR teased there, we will start the show with some updates on the June window. We were aware that the Nations League games on June 10th and 14th versus Curaçao at home and Honduras away, respectively, were going to be part of this. We just didn't know where the home game was going to be played in the Nations League, as well as what's going to happen with that friendly that we have been hyping up for the last 2 months. Before we get to the latter, the former was answered in the form of BC Place. That is going to be the host venue for the Curaçao home match. And AGR, you can definitely say deserved for the city that they're finally getting a men's national team game after, what, just over 3 years since the last time they hosted.
Yeah, pretty much almost 3.5 years. Based on the last time they played French Guiana, Nations League qualifier beginning of 2019. A while to think how far things have come since then. But yes, I think it was long overdue, especially with Vancouver coming back into the race for the World Cup bid hosting process, along with the fact that they just weren't able to get any games out to Vancouver at all. And the World Cup qualifiers, they obviously want to get one or two of the Edmonton games there. And then due to logistical, concerns and the venue being booked for one of the games, they decided to go for Edmonton. So it ultimately didn't work out for Vancouver. They obviously wanted to come to Vancouver. And I think it's been clear since they started putting in the legwork for this June window that Vancouver was going to be the goal. I mean, Montreal sounds like they made some sort of a push, but ultimately Vancouver was always going to win that battle, especially given recent events. And obviously, as we've seen with this game, that's, part of the battle's won. And as we'll see in a bit, there's more to add to the Vancouver story.
There is. So let's answer that part of it just so we can have the full-fledged conversation here. We did get a couple listener questions about the friendly as well as just what the June window is going to look like. So Dan Clark asked us, any news on the June window, venues, friendly opponents, anything? And then Van S at Vans_Jets asked, any truth to the Iran friendly with the Canadian men's national team? It was reported via Iranian media. So sources of the Northern Football Podcast can confirm that report, that a friendly with Iran on June 5th, I believe it is, at BC Place will happen, which is going to precede this Curaçao match, which means you get the chance to get two pretty solid crowds in a stadium that holds upwards of 54,000 people. Alex, we were told that in January, when Canada was determining where they were going to play that home match against the US, that the CSA specifically was very keen on BC Place because of the potential for high gate revenues. They were recovering from a pandemic. They needed the cash injection. That is kind of what they leaned towards. But then because John Herdman and the sporting side of things preferred to stay on the East Coast, they had the cold weather experiences in Edmonton, they figured, hey, let's just stick to the East Coast, cut down our travel time, and we'll go from there. And the Federation obliged. This, I know, may not, I feel, excite a lot of listeners hearing that Iran is going to be the opponent, but it still is a marquee opponent in the fact that it's a World Cup team. They're going to be playing against the United States in their group, which is going to be fiery to say the least. So this is kind of, I suppose, like a you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours situation for the United States and Canada. And not to mention, too, there's a heavy Iranian population in the lower mainland. So you can imagine they're going to get a pretty solid crowd. I feel like there's no real disadvantage to having this be the friendly and the friendly opponent.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot to unpack with that. I mean, firstly, yeah, it's not, let's say, sexy. And I think that is a big, of course, that's something that's going to be a bit of a disappointment. And I mean, it's hard not to blame them, because I mean, some of the names I heard that Canada were in talks with were, you know, big names, like, you know, maybe after, you know, after the this Iranian game is officially announced, maybe I'll share some of the names I heard. But, you know, there were some fun teams in there, teams you're listening, like, okay, this is a big game friendly, but ultimately we're going to have to find out, like, what was it, the turf that hindered those talks? Was it just, you know, too slow to play ball? Some of them did end up you know, scheduling friendlies elsewhere with other countries. So maybe it was just a matter of, you know, logistics not lining up for the teams, travel, et cetera. I think ultimately in terms of Iran itself in a bubble, I think this is a great friendly in the sense that Iran's ranked 21st in the world, as they showed at the last World Cup. They were a tough, tough out, and they've continued to improve since then. They've do got a, you know, a solid group of players playing in some good leagues, some good levels. You got some, you know, just off the top of my head, guys like Sardar Azmoun and Ali Reza Yahanbash, you know, some very solid, you know, also another one, Ali Reza Linkbarovan, the goalkeeper who saved Ronaldo's penalty. He plays in the Portuguese league, and there's a host of other top Iranian talents playing in top leagues. So I think it's a very solid team. Like you mentioned, Peter, very, very strong Persian community here in Vancouver. I think that will certainly be of excitement to them. Obviously, given Canada's form, I think it's going to be a very strong Canadian contingent, but maybe we'll see a whole host of, you know, maybe Canadian, Iranian, you know, not dual nationals. It feels wrong to use in a non-sporting sense, but, you know, you get what I mean in terms of a lot of Canadian, Iranian folk will probably head out to just cheer on the game. And I think 55,000, that's very doable for both games, honestly, not just Iran. I think Curaçao as well, given the form Canada's in, people are going to want to come see these games. It's going to be Canada's last games in Canada before the World Cup, unless something wild happens in September. So it's going to be a huge opportunity for Canada, a huge opportunity for Vancouver. So even though it's not the marquee friendlies, I think this is a very solid opponent. And I think it'll be a good test for Canada to go against one of the best defensive and, you know, well-rounded teams in the world.
It is, I think, palpable that it's going to be a pretty large event, because when is the last time Vancouver has hosted a large sporting event like this? And the fact that this is in a way going to be part of the men's send-off, you imagine that there's going to be at least 30 to 40,000 people going to either of those games, if not more. Depending on how they price the tickets and whatnot too, I think that could have a lot to do with it as well. Like, the sporting aspect's interesting to me because I was talking to a family member of mine who was asking, well, considering Canada's going to be playing against teams like Croatia and Belgium, who are going to be expected to, I suppose, control the game for the most part, is Iran really the best opponent for that? I think Iran is actually sneaky, sneaky good in this regard. Like, they can also play a little bit. They're not just going to sit back and grind out results, because they had to in the group they had in 2018, apart from that Morocco game. And even then, they still had chances. And we have seen Canada's issues breaking down deep blocks. So even if that's how they set up, I feel like this is kind of a win-win situation here.
Yeah, I mean, also we have to remember that, you know, Iranian team at the time, that was also a Carlos Kiroš coach team. And for people who've seen him coach internationally, he's very, you know, he's known for being a very stingy, you know, defensive coach. They saw that even against Morocco, where, you know, on paper, Iran was the favorites, arguably on paper, and they still played very defensive and snatched a 1-0 goal. That's just kind of how they play. But I think, you know, ever since they've, you know, he moved on to ironically ended up coaching Morocco. You look at some of the results, they are a lot of a tight game. So they've kind of maintained that sort of defensive principles. You look at a lot of their World Cup qualifiers, like it's 1-0 against Iraq, 1-0 against Syria, 3-0 over Iraq, 1-0 over the UAE, you know, 2-1 over Lebanon, 3-0 over Syria. Like, for the most part, those are tight results defensively, but also they, as you can see, there's a few 2-0 games, 3-0 games. They're starting to score more. They have, you know, they're starting to get more and more offensive options. Obviously, the main man up top are Azmoun with 40 goals and 62 caps for Iran, currently plays at Bayer Leverkusen. That's, you know, a very top number nine, a very good number nine at that position. So I think Iran certainly maybe not an offensive juggernaut. I'm not going to sit there and pretend that Canada's taken on, you know, a team with world-class attacking options, say like a Brazil or, you know, or an Argentina or something like that. But I still think they're very well-rounded units, how I describe Iran, with a slight edge on the defensive side of things.
I'd agree with that. And at the end of the day, European teams were not an option because of their Nations League commitments. A lot of the South American teams already made their plans months and months in advance. Like Brazil's going to Australia and Asia in general in June. Argentina already scheduled a few friendlies before that. Uruguay and Ecuador, yes, they weren't assured of their places officially until basically the March window. But even before then, they could probably see, all right, we're going to get in or at the very least get a playoff. Let's start preparing for that. Canada, because of their, I guess, lack of resources, how understaffed they are, etc., it was going to be tough. But it's not like they didn't try. And at the end of the day, this is still a pretty solid game, all things considered. So I am looking forward to seeing this.
And hey, there's still September. I'll just add, there's still September. Hopefully, if they, you know, maybe they'll make up with it with some high profile UEFA and CONMEBOL in September, especially if their plan is to go to Europe with the purpose of preparing.
We move on to the Canadians Abroad Roundup. Another busy weekend for some of our players overseas. Alphonso Davies went the full 90 minutes in Bayern Munich's 2-2 draw with Stuttgart on Sunday, a 10-man Bayern Munich, I will add. He looked like his old self in that one, which is great to see, cutting inside a lot, dictating the game, setting up a couple of really good chances, so that was pretty assuring. Jonathan David yet again was goalless in Lille's loss to Monaco on Friday. There was a report, Alex, from La Voix du Nord, that David could stay at Lille for another season due to some clubs being put off by his recent poor form and the 50 million euro asking price that Lille is reportedly demanding. Do you see that happening?
It's such a like chicken and egg situation, I think, right now with Jonathan David and Lille. Like I watched that game specifically. I was, you know, trying to really see, like, focusing in on Jonathan David, seeing like, okay, let's see against an opponent like Monaco, what is he gonna, you know, bring in that situation. It just wasn't working for him, and he got brought off after 55 minutes. Funnily enough, Lille started to wake up, and that's where I'm really starting to wonder if you know, Jocelyn Gouvernec, the coach, if it's really the right fit between the two right now, at least in terms of ever since January, it's just really gone apart. So because of that, for Jonathan David, so I think to kind of answer the main question, will his form, you know, consider him to stay in Lille? Very strongly, I think, if based on what the asking price is going to be, with each game, it's going to be harder and harder for teams to meet that. Not saying that it won't happen. Maybe there is a team that's going to take the risk, pay that money, and then maybe this isn't talked about. But I do think the thing is, when a striker isn't scoring, there isn't going to be that bidding war. It's not going to be a, you know, as much of a competition for his, you know, his signing as it was, say, 3-4 months ago. So I think it's an absolutely a case based on his form. I think he'll stay. But there's also the situation, whereas if I think you're watching Jonathan David right now, you'll know it's not as much him. It is him in the sense that, yes, he could be doing better in busting out this slump. And there are some moments where maybe his touch looks off. He's not in, maybe not completely 100% in, but also the system is doing him zero favors right now. So I think it's a very, you know, chicken or egg situation. I think ultimately, based on what we're seeing, I'd say he's trending towards he stays. But if he stays, it would have to be with a new coach and some new signings. So I think just right now, the state of Lille if the directors are looking at this and they want to keep David around in the current system, they're better off selling him for what they can get at this point, because it's hard to imagine his asset going any higher unless they bring in a new coach and bring in some new signings, as drastic as that may be.
Yeah, well, Gouvernec, it would be hard to see him staying, to be honest, given how toxic it's become. The ultras were protesting in that game as well, which we saw, like, they had a banner up there, which basically said, "We're on vacation, just like you," that their message towards the players and the coaching staff, which I thought is just amazing, because I'm like, the fee really is the big thing here. Because David was bought for 30 million euros, Yes, that's amortized over time. He signed, what, a 4-year contract, I believe it was, when he joined. So you divide the 30 million euros by four, that is how much is amortized and or put on the books every year. So they've had him there for now 2 seasons, or what will be 2 seasons after this, which means you've paid off about half the fee already. At this point, they're looking to make a hefty, hefty profit by trying to sell him for 50. Plus, there's a sell-on going Gent's way when he is sold, so you got to take that into account. But even still, they could probably afford to sell him for a bit less than that, maybe 35, 40, still make a pretty decent profit on the books, that is, and still be able to give Gent a sizable enough sell-on fee, not to mention David would then get the move that he pretty clearly desires at this point. Let's be honest, I'm sure that's also contributing to the form in a lot of ways, but no doubt about it, it's tactical, but it's also partially down to him in that he's had a few opportunities to break this dry spell and just hasn't been able to put the ball away. And as we discussed last week and even a couple weeks ago, Alex, when you are a player like David and you've gone through 2 spells like this already, having stepped into a top 5 league, and you're anticipating making an even bigger step up, clubs will pay attention to that. So I feel like it's not a coincidence that we're seeing this, to be honest. As we transition to probably the in-form Canadian striker, not just in France, but in the world, Ike Ugbo. He helped Troyes earn a stunning 2-2 draw with PSG at Parc des Princes on Sunday, which could end up salvaging their status in Ligue 1, depending on what happens over the next few days here. I know we discussed this a lot, Alex, but surely Herdman gives him a start in either Nations League game or in that Iran friendly, no?
Easy. Start him, pick one of Kyle Larin or Jonathan David based on form, fatigue, and give him a run, because with the form, I mean, we're talking about it every week, because he's going out and surpassing the expectations we seemingly set for him from the week prior. Ike Ugbo is getting better and better each week. He's continue to score against higher and higher profile opponents. His XG continues to be good. You just look at the finish that he got against PSG, just the way he pounced on a turnover, took a touch, and just ripped it past Keylor Navas, of all people, not any old goalkeeper, one of the best in the world, and obviously the best in CONCACAF, just in a snapshot, the way he ripped it. It was fantastic to see. With the questions with Ike Ugbo now, it's getting so much bigger than should he start for Canada in this window. It's starting to be like, could he very well be the starting striker for Canada at the World Cup later this year? It's really starting to trend that way. I think obviously until we see him start a game for Canada, period, I'm not going to be making grand proclamations like that. But if we're already starting to entertain that discussion, 100% he needs to start against at least one of these 2 games, or I guess it's 3 technically, one of these 3 games, if not all 3, just to really see what Canada has in him, because it's starting to be clear with every game that he plays that Canada might have picked up a real gem here when he committed back in November.
That's the thing. I think a lot of people, when he committed, were excited because they saw his pedigree, they saw the trajectory he was on in Belgium, and they thought, oh yeah, this is a solid, solid addition. But now that he's moved to a big 5 league and he has taken it by storm, and when he joined Troyes, I literally said, yeah, 5-6 goals from now till the end of the season. And I think you would take that for sure. Like that would be not meeting expectations, but that would be like, wow, okay, that's a pretty solid output there, especially given the situation Troyes was in. And really the finite number of chances he has had. He's averaging, 1.6, 1.7 shots per 90, which is not very high for top 5 European strikers, at least according to the data on fbref.com right now. And he's averaging close to 0.3 XG per shot, which is just stupid good. Like, I can't put into words how ridiculous that is. He's averaging 0.5 XG, nearly 0.6 goals per 90. And it's not like he's only played like 400 or 500 minutes. He's played about 800 minutes now. So it's getting to the point where the sample size is getting large enough where you're like, yeah, he could probably keep this going for the next little while. And just the confidence he has in front of goal and the way he can get into position.
He is now clinical.
Starting to get involved in the build-up more, where he's maybe not only a poacher, he could maybe help you out in other ways. you have to start him in one of these games at the very least. And then, yeah, depending on how the next season starts, maybe he gets into that conversation to start some of the pre-World Cup friendlies and then therefore takes a starting spot. We will have to find out. But a really strong end of the season for Ugbo, and it'll be intriguing to see what happens over the next 3-4 months with him as he continues to turn heads over there. In Belgium, speaking of Ugbo's old home, Tejan Buchanan's Club Bruges defeated Union Saint-Gilloise in a top-of-the-table clash on Sunday. That was a massive result for them. Buchanan started at right wing back, though, and helped set up the team's opening goal, scored by Charles de Ketelera. Stefan Eustachio checked into Porto's 1-0 win over Benfica in the 87th minute and has officially won the Primeira Liga title as a result. Congratulations to him. Now we just see if this loan is made permanent as was initially anticipated. At the bottom of the table in Portugal, Steven Vitória's Moreirense is in the relegation zone and 1 point adrift of the playoff with one game remaining after losing to Estoril. We got a question about this last week, Alex, but with Vitória's contract ending soon, if they go down, could you see him moving to a CF Montreal or really anywhere else in MLS? But we did get the question specifically from a Montreal perspective, which I can't really see myself.
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to say. I don't think Montreal specifically, just because, you know, obviously, you know, that was a lot of talk about that preseason. Then they bring back Camacho, and then you see how good Joel Waterman's been, and the fact that they haven't even had to use Alistair Johnson as a center back because of how good Joel Waterman's been, and then Kamal Miller's recent resurgence, and, you know, and the fact that they always, if needed, they at worst comes to worst, I'm sure they'll just recall a Karifa Yao if they really get hit into a dire straits based on how he's been playing. So ultimately for Vitória, it's going to be interesting to see where he heads, because he is a free agent. So, you know, even if Morense goes down, he's not going to be tied to them in any situation. He is familiar with MLS. Of course, someone will remember that he played with the Philadelphia Union back in the day for a season, which imagine that today. For me, honestly, for him, just any sort of landing spot where he can play regularly, preferably on grass, right off the top of my head, thinking their center back situation. A Toronto FC wouldn't, you know, the wages might be a bit high on Vitória's end, but if they can make it work, a Toronto FC, they play on grass, they need some center back depth, some veteran presence on their team. Maybe that could be a way for them to vault into a back, you know, three more often. Because I think you look at their depth every week, one of their center backs is injured or suspended between, what was it, Mavinga, Salcedo, O'Neill, McNaughton, usually Salcedo suspended or Mavinga's injured. Wouldn't hurt to have a Vitória in there. I suppose his injury history would be a bit of a cause for concern, but I just think he needs some sort of regular playing time, because it's going to be hard to go into Qatar and having him had already the first 5 months he's had, you know, in terms of his club playing. If he goes into that into November, like, it might be a matter of he might not start, not because you don't want him to, he's a great defender, but if he's played like five times at a certain point, you have to ask if guys who are playing, you know, are better options. So I think 100% Vitória should move to a league that plays him. If it's MLS, it's MLS. And hey, if he can stay in Portugal or something like that, I think that would also suit him, again, assuming he plays.
That's another interesting situation. Speaking of Ugbo's club future, Steven Vitória's is also up there, along with a few others. In Turkey, speaking of club futures that are intriguing, Kyle Larin started and should have had a brace in Beşiktaş's draw with Fenerbahçe on Sunday. He partnered Michy Batshuayi up front again for a second consecutive game. Atiba Hutchinson was a late substitute as well. There was a report in Turkish newspaper Sporks that Larin might actually start to be warming towards staying at Beşiktaş, because he reportedly hasn't received adequate enough offers in his eyes from everywhere else in the continent. So we'll have to see what happens over the next couple of weeks here, because Valerian Ismail does have a lot of say in that regard. Sam Adekubi provided the assist for Hatyspor's equalizer against champions Trabzonspor on Friday. Adekubi didn't have too many opportunities to get forward, but when he did, he certainly made it count, that's for sure. Over to the championship, where Richie Larea started for the first time as Nottingham Forest drew 1-1 with Hull City. They finished fourth in the championship table and clinch a promotion playoff spot, which will begin in a few days. But on Larea specifically, having watched this in full, Alex, he was very, very good under the circumstances. And you can see that even if Forrest don't go up, he'll be an effective player in the championship 100%. And the tenacity he has out there, he was making a lot of visiting supporters very, very happy.
Every time I watch him with Forrest, I mean, it's obviously been limited viewing. He definitely seems up to the level. I think that's not a question. He appears to have the technical skills required to play in the championship. You know, he's showing the same things he did in MLS, where he's able to dribble guys too, and defending as well. He's getting stuck in. And then, as we know with Richie Larea, he's always going to be willing to go in the fight. He's going to be up for it. And I think, again, if for the English play style, or it's a big part of their game to be stuck in and to be engaged in and ready for the battle. I think Richie Larea, 100%, he has all the attributes needed for the championship. So I think it's going to be a good situation for him if, you know, Forrest stay in the division as much as you want them to go up. If he stays, you know, I have to assume Jed Spence goes to greener pastures. Mm-hmm. And then that allows Larea to be the guy next year. And that's not a bad thing. Also, I mean, I of course want to see how he would do in the Premier League if he goes up. And hey, maybe if he goes up, there's some sort of loan worked out to a very good championship club. Either way, I think right now with Larea, things are looking good for him next year. I think either way, because I mean, I guess Forrest, as we suppose, it depends on who they buy in the transfer window at wingback to replace Jed Spence, or if they just buy Jed Spence. But Larea's already, you know, seemed to be very well integrated into the squad. So should they stay down or should they go up? I'd like to be optimistic of his hopes to play based on what he continues to show under, you know, for Steve Cooper.
So would I. And I think that was always the plan, to get him ready for next season, to be honest, with maybe the possibility he could have gotten some minutes over the first few months he was there, but just because of Forrest's form and Jed Spence staying at the club when it looked like he was going to be going back to Middlesbrough, it just sort of threw everything into disarray, unfortunately. But good to see that he's finishing the season strong there. Junior Hoylett started in Reading's final match of the season, a 1-0 loss to playoff-bound Luton Town. His contract is up in June. So what do you think is next for Hoylett, given that he was in this exact same situation last year?
And then 3 years before that, too, he always seems to end up in the situation where he's out of contract. Very good player. You know, I think as long as he stays in a championship level or higher, I think he's good in the championship. You just look, I think he finished with 3 goals and it was 4 assists in the counting stats. Could have had many more, as you know, as his expected stats were very decent. He completes a lot of dribbles, key passes. He's very much up the level for the championship. So if he stays in the championship, I'd assume he stays with Reading. I think after the January, once they went through that absolute nightmare stretch in December, they got some signings. They kind of sorted things out and they looked, you know, a lot better in the second half. So maybe, I guess the idea is, you know, they build off of it. I also think they fired their manager as well. You know, the former Chicago Fire manager, Vlatko Panovic, I think it is. All a very interesting connection there. So obviously with Reading, if they continue on the form they're going, I'd like him to stay. But as a free agent, it would be interesting. Like, does the championship club who go up consider signing him on a free? I think that would be a very smart move for a Premier League team. He's shown to be also capable of the level. I think he's massively underrated, even though, you know, yes, he's 31. His legs aren't what he used to be back in the day, but he is such a smart and cerebral player and is developing into such a good number 10 / inverted winger at this age. If not, maybe go to MLS and dominate. But I think personally for him, I think stay at Reading, go to the Premier League. But if for whatever reason things don't work out, whoever signs him as like a DP in MLS is going to pay them dividends. But I think it might just be a little too soon for him and that, because he still has the quality to play at a higher level.
Yes, I 100% agree. And even if you look at how Reading finished the season under Paul Ince, who is there on an interim basis, if he gets the job permanently, he seemed to really trust Hoylett with running the attack in a lot of cases. So that's another reason to stay as well. Daniel Jebison got about 15 minutes for Sheffield United in their huge 4-0 win over Fulham to set up a promotion playoff semifinal with Larea's Forest. Their first leg is on Saturday at Bramall Lane, and the second leg is at City Ground next Tuesday. Should be a fun one. Speaking of promotion playoffs, in League One, Theo Corbin, who started as MK Dons, bowed out of the playoffs despite a 1-0 win over Wycombe Wanderers in the second leg of their semifinal, a 2-0 first leg loss did them in the end. Corbinieu had 5 shots in this one, 2 of which were nearly converted. He was all over the place in this one, but kind of the same old story with him. He just wasn't really getting others involved, but I think in this case it was pretty justified because Wickham were just sitting back and absorbing pressure. They got outshot 29-2. Which is absurd, and they only conceded the 1 goal. Like, even if you look at the expected goals, Alex, it was crazy. It was something like 2.6 to like 0.06 or something, and somehow, some way, they could not get the second goal, MK Dons, and now they're out.
Gareth Ainsworth masterclass, I'll add.
There we go.
You know.
In the second Bundesliga, Scott Kennedy played the entire second half in Jan Regensburg's 2-0 loss to Heidenheim on Sunday. Milan, Borjan, and Red Star Belgrade defeated Stefan Mitrovic's Radnički Niš in a 4-1 win to move one step closer to the Serbian Superliga title. As for Mitrovic, he scored his team's lone goal, his 10th of the campaign, a brilliant achievement for him. He's probably going to be another one looking for a move to a bigger club this summer. In MLS, Dane St. Clair continued to make his case to start a game for Canada along with EK Ugbo next month with a monumental performance for Minnesota United, who lost 1-0 to FC Cincinnati on a late Brandon Vasquez equalizer, which St. Clair could do nothing about, but he did everything he possibly could to keep Minnesota in this one and very nearly did pull it off in the end. Maxime Crépeau, on the other hand, faced 2 shots, let them both in, as LAFC and the Philadelphia Union settled for a 2-2 draw on Saturday. He's now saving 0.5 goals below expected this season. Quite the stark difference from 2021. But as we discussed, Alex, it's just a case of kind of figuring out that new challenge of, hey, I'm not seeing as many shots. How can I stay focused and make sure that I make the crucial saves I need? But the last couple of weeks, he slipped up. Before that, looked pretty solid. I'm not too concerned yet.
All I have to say is, you know, as much as I don't want to use this argument too often, it's in Maxime Crépeau's and LAFC's case, it's obvious. Just look at the standings. They're first in MLS by a couple points. The reason they brought in Max Crépeau, as you look last year, was their expected numbers were marvelous. The only reason that they didn't make the playoffs is because they had some historically awful goalkeeping. All they needed was league average goalkeeping. They brought in a well above league average goalkeeper. Yeah, even if he fall, you know, reverts to the mean, they'll still be dominant. And he has reverted to the mean a bit, and they've still been dominant. And I think it's also part of the system. They're so dominant in the sense where you watch him, he only gets, like this game, 1 or 2 shots a game, often high danger, because when you're playing a high line, the only chances you're going to be giving up are breakaways, are, you know, shots right in front of you. So I think it's going to be a really boom or bust system for Crépeau. So yeah, well, I think he'll adjust and they'll be, I think there his better numbers are to come for him. He's also in such a system where it's not going to be as much about the numbers for the way LAFC plays. It's going to be about results. And right now I think you look at the results and Max Crepo's done everything they've needed from him so far. And I guess that's scary in a sense that he could have another level on top of that. And I'll also add again with the play he's done on the ball for them has also been super underrated. And yes, while he's not saving as much as you'd like, his you know, sweeping already I thought was at a great level. It's improved to an even higher level. So I think ultimately everything is fit so far, and things will only get better, which is again scary, and it's probably why if you're a betting favorite, as long as Carlos Vela stays healthy and everyone stays healthy, I'd bet good money on this LAFC team doing you know, at least winning the Shield and maybe making a good run in the playoffs.
As do I. Marc-Anthony Kay started in the Colorado Rapids defeat to the San Jose Earthquakes and could have picked up where he left off last week with a goal, but couldn't put away one of his 3 shots. One of them was actually quite decent. Unfortunate not to put it away, and probably could have had a handball on that. Finally, Raheem Edwards keeps turning heads as he looked lively on both sides of the pitch for the LA Galaxy, who defeated Austin FC 1-0 on Saturday. From the roundup to the Canucks abroad mailbag we go. We'll start with a couple of questions on a similar theme here. First from PJ Dooley. Do you guys have any inkling that any dual nationals or first-timers will be making the Nations League squad? Mitrovic, Diash, Jebison, etc. Chris Wengel on a similar note asked, any rumors of potential call-ups for Nations League? I've said Stefan Mitrovic for the last few weeks, Alex. I think this is the time for him. And if he doesn't get called up, I'd be pretty disappointed and a little bit surprised, unless Serbia made a push for him to come into their Nations League squad.
Well, that's a battle that Canada should be trying to fight, I think, right now. Because, I mean, you look at Mitrovic, he just hit his 10th goal in a top flight. Sounds like some sort of move is coming for him this year. You look long-term with no Scott Arfield, obviously him retiring. David Weatherspoon, he's not young and he's coming off a major knee injury. The number 10 position long-term for Canada, this is a chance to secure a very good option there. Obviously, you look at the, you get your all-star-eyed with your Marcelo Floreses and your Lucas Diazes. And again, A, they could both turn out to be great players, and also B, have to win the battle with Mexico in Flores's case. But in Mitrovic, you have a player right now in a top flight doing a lot of things that you'd want Diaz or Flores to eventually do in their respective clubs. So I think with Mitrovic, it's a case of the future and the present are lining very well. You got the fact it is Nations League. And hey, even if he isn't ready to commit, you could always bring him in just for the Iran friendly, give him a taste. And then, depending on where he moves in the fall, depending on how he progresses, you could at least and then put your hands up and say, at least we showed you what we have to offer and show that you're interested. So for me, Mitrovic is the big no-brainer. Again, like at least I've reiterated, until a lot of these guys start playing for the World Cup squad, it's going to be tough. A lot of them, again, I'm so super excited for ahead of 2026, a lot of these guys. But in terms of dual nationals, right now, my list stops and ends with Stefan Mitrovic.
I'm the same. And the fact he does have to file the one-time switch to play for Canada officially in competitions like the Nations League and potentially the World Cup, we'll see, might muddy the waters a little bit. However, bringing him in for a friendly, that's the win-win scenario, right? You can bring him in. If you have a camp a few days ahead of that friendly, all the more reason to get him integrated into the team, see how he likes it. Maybe he's like, yeah, I'm ready to file my one-time switch and we'll do it. The other one is Marcelo Flores for me, just because I think he might still want to see what the Canada setup's like, maybe use that as leverage against Mexico. And you know what? Let him at this point. I don't really care all that much if he does, because this is what players do. And to be honest, I don't think he's going to choose Canada in the end, but at least you can say, hey, we gave it our best shot. He prefers Mexico. The family prefers him to play for Mexico. They seem pretty keen to bring him in, although Tata Martino has been weird with that a little bit. But at least the Federation seems keen to bring him in. So at the very least, you're playing with house money at that point, and that's the good side of it. Interesting question here, Alex. Four Turns asked us, name five players who were in World Cup qualifying / Gold Cup squads in the past year that shouldn't be named to Canada's Qatar squad. This is difficult for me. Because
that's a brutal question, too.
First of all, it's ruthless and savage, but I love it because it makes me think very, very hard about this. Second of all, I feel like the first name that's going to be on everybody's mind, I can hear the listeners just screaming it into our heads. Lucas Cavallini! Lucas Cavallini doesn't deserve to be in there. The provider, by the way, of the winning goal over the weekend. We'll get into that later. I guess he would be one, I guess, just because of the depth for me. Some might say Daniil Henry, but I personally would not take him out. I think he has been very low-key solid in his last few Canada games. And as long as he's contracted to an MLS team like LAFC, he deserves to get in. Derek Cornelius might be the odd man out here, I feel, just because of all the left-footed center back options you have. If you roll with Miller as well as Kennedy in those positions, then all the more reason. Other than that, maybe guys like Theo Corbenu because of the winger depth, and possibly Ismail Kone if David Weatherspoon is fit and Sam Piet ends up playing the way he did over the weekend. Those are really the only names I can think of off the top of my head that you can say should not be in the squad, but should not, I think, is a little bit harsh on them. More so, you can make the argument to leave them off and no one would bat an eye.
It's a tough question because I guess it depends on what sort of pool we're drawing from. Are we talking about everyone who played for Canada? Are we talking about everyone who got called up regularly? Is it just from a 23-man squad? Because, I mean, for example, someone like James Pantemis. Technically, with Dane Sinclair's quiet run, James Pantemis was the number three for a while. I think right now it'd be easy to scratch him out given on how Dane Sinclair's playing. But kind of operating on an emphasis on the guys who are kind of on the fringe. I mean, that's Derek Cornelius. We'll make it tougher. I think Derek Cornelius, Christian Gutierrez, too. I guess it's hard to say what you could count Christian Gutierrez as, but I think definitely Derek Cornelius a bit on the fringes. I think, unfortunately, someone like Liam Fraser, as good as he's been for Canada, I think he just might also be on that cusp. I think it's hard because I think everyone has their defined role. That's why it's such a ruthless question. Because like maybe if we're purely talking tactically, Marc-Anthony Kay did fall off a bit. So maybe I could say him. I mean, obviously you see in terms of leadership and in terms of when the system suits him, he's a locked in, you know, guy for Canada. But maybe if we're trying to be ruthless and eliminate names, I'd say maybe a Marc-Anthony Kay, ditto for Liam Miller, based on the fact like Kay, he doesn't fit the system. So if we're going to be really ruthless, those are maybe some of those guys I'd add to your names. But again, I think that's a tough thing with Canada right now. They're 1-23 so set. It's not like some cases where it's a 1-18 set and it's like five wide open doors. Like some of these guys from 1 to even 25, it's very set, and it's going to be interesting to see how the battle unfolds because of how tight things are.
For sure. It's an interesting question though, and I'm sure a lot of listeners would have many different answers. It'd be interesting to see what some of you guys have to say about this. Maybe tweet at us and we can have a conversation about it. MJeffS72 asked, which do you think is the best route for young Canadian players to make it professionally? L1 Ontario, BC, etc., CPL MLS, or Europe-based club academies / clubs to play in Europe professionally? The simple answer to this, Alex, I feel, is there really isn't like one perfect place, because when you look at someone like, for example, Liam Miller, goes to the Liverpool Academy at a young age, cracks the first team once or twice, gets a couple of loans, but now he's fully established in a solid top-flight European league, and you have to imagine the Liverpool connections helped him. But then you have the cases of guys like Tejon Buchanan, who went through the NCAA system, got drafted, sold for a club record fee to Club Bruges. Now he's settling in Europe just fine. I would just say that as the game grows in this country, the more options you have at home, the better, because not everybody has the passport to be able to go over or just the means to be able to go over to Europe. But it's such a cop-out answer. I just feel like there's really no one ideal route.
I think it's early to have a grandstanding discussion like this just because we have to see how the pathway will develop. I mean, I think the question really harkens me back to a conversation we had with John Herdman in 2019, the last time Canada was in Vancouver. It was obviously back at the beginning of Canada's kind of journey to where they are now. And I remember Herdman having like a five-minute long answer about something like that. He was talking about how he was fascinated with all the different pathways coming into Canadian soccer and how all these players have taken such different journeys. And I mean, you see it with this team. You got Alistair Johnson, who went the League One to NCAA to MLS route. You got, you know, a guy like Kamal Miller did something similar. Tejon Buchanan, who did a route like that to Europe. You got Alfonso Davies, who is a star now, but he started in MLS. You got Jonathan David, who just foregone, he skipped MLS and went straight to Europe, and it's paying off for him. There is really no, you know, ideal route. I think long-term, I think the route we're going to see a lot of people take, and I think it'll be the one where we'll see the most productivity. So I guess to sort of answer your question is, once these paths are defined, is like a League One when you're like a teenager, and then CPL when you're like just about to reach, you know, being an adult officially, or, you know, like 17, 18, 19, then maybe you come up to MLS, for your 18, 19, 20, and then you move to Europe. Maybe that'll kind of be a pathway where you kind of get to touch on each of those branches and continue to grow at each stage, but you're not staying at one place too long, and ultimately you make it to Europe. I think that'll be an ideal path. Obviously, some will, you know, be generational at 15. They'll already be playing in MLS like a Davies, and they'll go straight up. Some will take their time, but I think that might be end up being the ideal route long-term, I guess, sort of answer your question.
Let's get to a little bit of rapid fire to close up the mailbag here. So the Final Whistle asked, which Canadian men's national team player do you see earning a transfer this summer? Would love to see our MLS starters earn a move away. Also, do you see any of the TFC Canadians / youngsters earning a move abroad? AGR, what say you?
I mean, I guess to start, we haven't really talked to, about some of the guys in Europe. Cause I think with MLS, again, like we mentioned, a lot of interesting situations. One guy I'm looking at though, over in Europe, is a guy who could potentially get a move, Scott Kennedy. He's been at John Regensburg for a couple of years now. He's obviously shown to be of the level and sometimes even above that. Like we also talked about recently, some not holes in his game, some areas in his game might, you know, not be super attractive to scouts right now, but there are also a lot in his game that is very attractive to scouts and higher levels. I think a guy like Scott Kennedy could push for a move to a higher level. I think Derek Cornelius maybe as well, based on what he's shown in Greece and based on some of the rumors, there could be, you know, a move for him. So I guess two center backs are two of them I'm looking at. A third name I'll throw in there just because Liam Fraser, I think surely based on how things have ended this year, maybe a move, you know, to a higher level could suit him. And then just to round off with a list of five names, I'm obviously Hoylett and Vitória based on their contract situations and based on the fact that maybe they could be, you know, apt for a move. It might not be sexy, those answers, but those are kind of a handful of regulars I could see.
Toss in Derek Cornelius as well, because I know there are reports that Panathinaikos might pick up their purchase option and then flip him for profit somewhere. Ferencváros from Hungary were apparently interested a few months ago, but ultimately Panathinaikos decided to keep him. But they do have some key injuries at the back, and the thinking is they might just pick up that option, sign Cornelius, but then keep him either for the rest of the loan or then, as I said, pick up that option permanently and then have him for the however long they want to have him for, just because they do need to fill some gaps there for next season. As for the TFC youngsters, I don't really see anybody getting a move this early. I feel like just because Ioaki Nola's just come back, Jaquil Marshall-Ruddy's hurt, those would have been the two prime candidates, but the situation just isn't really kind to them right now, but we'll see, because there are some promising players coming through that academy every single day. WSoccer.ca asks, could you do a little roundup of the Canadian women in Sweden? Seems like a great fit for emerging talent, to say the least. Yes. Sabrina D'Angelo went 90 in a 2-2 draw with Hammarby, the Canadian goalkeeper over there. Sarah Stratagakis scored one of Vizio's goals in that draw as she went 89 minutes in that game. She continues to start the season on a flyer. At Kristianstad, Evelyn Vien went the full 90 and should have scored yet again. I feel like that's the story of her season so far. Gabriel Carl had 73 at left back, but Vien, if she just starts taking shots first time, Alex, I feel like that would transform everything for her, because I feel like at least in this point in time, she's kind of hesitating in front of goal when she's getting in promising positions, when if she was just a little more incisive, she's going to get a couple more goals easily. Paige Culver had the full 90 at center back for Kalmar in a 4-2 loss to Orebo. And speaking of, Jenna Hellstrom played 81 minutes and scored for Orebo in that one. So yes, definitely a lot of action going on with our women in Sweden. That's nice to see. The final whistle. Any news on Tom Holmes? Haven't heard much since it was first announced he could potentially switch to Canada. I'm diving into this every single day. Still no real developments yet, hoping to get some sort of answers, but he is at least aware that he could be eligible. And I would imagine the CSA, having heard this news, I would imagine they have, are going to try to work on this. Arch Stanton, are we sleeping on Simon Collin as a striker prospect? And has he done enough to justify a permanent PSV move? Alex, we answered the latter and we said that yes, he certainly has. And he scored again over the weekend. So bolstering his case even more, I think the switch to a false nine under Ruud van Nistelrooy has been a very, very sly move on his part.
Yeah, I think it was an interesting one because there's some debate on it online. There are some questions about the Dutch second division. I think personally, it looks, from what I've seen, it looks like a pretty solid level, especially amongst second division teams. What I've always liked about the Netherlands as a whole, they're always, you know, very good at developing youngsters, and a lot of good players have come through the second division as a result of that. And I think the fact that Colijn was entrusted with such a big role under a high profile, you know, name like Ruud van Nistelrooy to be the number nine. Yes, as some pointed out, for number nine, okay, stats aren't, you know, eye popping. 5 goals, 3 assists. I think it ended up being for the season. But considering he didn't, you know, necessarily start the year in that role, and he kind of grew into it, he's not a natural striker. The link up play he showed, and also just watching him, his game grow by the end of the year, like he started to get some proper number nine finishes, number nine runs, number nine skills. You can really see him figure out that part of his game, and he's keeping that creative side of, okay, he can drop in and link up and whatnot. So I'd be very interested to see how PSV rate him? Is it going to be a case of you sign him, you bring him in for the first team? If not, you leave him as a second team mercenary. I think there's certainly the thing is with, you know, the Netherlands, typically they are a little more patient with their prospects. Some noted, yes, he is. I think he's almost turning 20 this year because he's an 02 born, which is, you know, wild to think. But I think that's still in the Netherlands that is considered relatively young. So if he does spend another year in the second division, maybe with some more call-ups to the first team next year, that's not a bad situation. If he makes the jump straight up to the first team, that's fantastic. But ultimately, I think it's going to be up to PSV. It's going to be up to Kolein, because it's hard to see him coming back to the Whitecaps. I think it would be great if he did from the Whitecaps perspective. It'd be nice to have a youngster like him who's had that taste of Europe, who can fill some of the holes they have. But I think ultimately it's going to be up to Kolein. And from what I see from PSV, it'd be hard to imagine them not bringing him back.
0.4 XG per 90 as a number 9 is pretty nice for anybody in any league. So he can build on that, that's for sure. Shane Wagenaar, has there been any news on Easton Ongaro? Had some early minutes with Uta Arad, scored a goal, then disappeared from the substitutes bench. Wondered if he might be hurt or just struggling to make the matchday squad. It seems to be the latter. I've seen nothing about an injury, which is very strange because he was just starting to kind of find his groove with the few minutes that he had. Scores the goal and then just gets dropped pretty much as soon as the Romanian league season's shifted from the regular season into a split table. So it's a strange one, but he does have a preseason coming up. Maybe he can impress and end up getting more regular minutes, because you do have to keep in mind he did join quite late in the season. Over to domestic matters, starting with MLS and CF Montreal, who won their 5th game in their last 6 after beating Orlando City 4-1. A lot of interesting developments in this one, from Joel Waterman's goal to Samuel Piette and Mathieu Chaunier returning and everything else really in between. But the story of the game, Alex, for me was probably Piette and Chaunier, but specifically the former player. So we got a question from Star, who asked, with Piette and Chaunier returning, is Kone's spot in the starting 11 at risk, and will it hinder his development? I'm going to let you answer this, because you got into my head yet again and pitched a pretty solid-looking potential 11 with all of those guys available.
Yeah, I think Ismail Kone is going to continue to play. I mean, it's certainly a question to be had. I think Chaunier, this guy, he can play in so many different positions. The fact that he stepped in seamlessly as a number 8 in a double pivot and looked competent, coming off an injury, I might add, is just a credit to him. And obviously, you know, when Victor Wanyama's coming back, he's going to start as much as he's available and healthy for. He's a DP, he's a very good player. He's been in excellent form this year. But I think Kone's already proven that he can be in that mix. He can bring something different as that number 8. It can bring that box-to-box profile, but do not forget he came up through the academy as a winger number 10. You know, with Montreal's system, it's so fluid. I think there's a room, there's a way to fit them all in. I mean, last year, Piette and Wanyama, they had mixed results together. There's some games where they would just click, some games where, you know, maybe wasn't always, you know, there. But I think based on how Piet's game has come on in the last year, we don't maybe talk about that enough, about how much Piette in the last few years has turned into a very, very good passer of the ball. Maybe him and Wanyama can be the double pivot. You bring back Mathieu Chaunier, play him at left wing back, because, you know, Lassie Lapalainen, and he's explosive, he's fun, he's wildly inconsistent and doesn't really suit that role. You got over on the right side, Alistair Johnston is somehow, you know, he surprised me. I always thought he was going to be a right center back for Montreal, and he's not only slotted in at right wing back, like, okay, maybe they want a bit of defensive solidity. He's up to 3 proper MLS, you know, proper assists this year. And I think he has also a couple secondary assists, yeah, and they're all nice pinpoint bullet crosses, yes, into the box. So he's showing to be a good right wing back starter. Good news for Montreal. Very unfortunate for Zachary Broguiard, by the way, who came off the bench and had some fun this weekend. And I think from there, that could free up Kone to maybe join Georgie Mihailovic in sort of a double number 10 / number 8s above Piette and Wanyama, and then let Kyoto play the lone role up top. I know some noted that Joaquin Torres is a potential deterrent to that. for me, he's just too inconsistent. Yes, there's some games where he looks like the second coming of Messi, but there's also other games where he just doesn't open up his hips enough and he just cuts inside and takes dumb shots.
So much.
He's so like boom or bust. And I just think because of that, a guy like Kone already at a young age has proven to be so much more consistent. So I think there's a path for Kone to stay in the lineup. Either he just stays in with Wanyama, you go with what works and bring in Piet as a super sub, which he, a role he played last year to no problem. Or if you really think Piet deserves to start, which is also a fair claim, this maybe lets Kone move up to more of his natural position, which could further unlock him, if anything.
I like it. And to be honest, Piet in that role over Wanyama, the difference in pace of play, the difference in the fluidity of Montreal's buildup from the back, everything just changed. Like, as influential as Wanyama has definitely been for some of the younger players, and yet can't look past anybody else but Ismail Kone in that regard, he's not the quickest anymore, and you see how much it impacts the team. And with Piet coming back in, it's going to be interesting, but that is certainly the way I would go too. Surprise, surprise. I agree with AGR. David K at David_Kiesman. Why are so few CF Montreal games on TV? I understand TSN has MLS rights, but they don't cover every game. 30 million English speaking Canadians would like to watch a good MLS team. Shots fired. The simple answer is TVA Sports are also an official broadcaster of Major League Soccer, and because they have the rights as well as the French language rights for CF Montreal, that is why they get the majority of the games. It's unfortunate, but that's just the way it is, unfortunately. Maybe that'll change as the season continues. Maybe TSN will try to buy a few games off of TVA there or something. We had an all-Canadian clash, though, on Sunday on TSN between Toronto FC and the Vancouver Whitecaps, who won, controversially, I might add, 1-0 thanks to former TFC man Tosin Ricketts and everyone's favorite number 9, Lucas Cavallini, providing the assist. A match, AGR, that you were at, I believe, on your birthday, no less, putting in the work regardless of what day it is. I'd love to see it. TFCNU asked a question related to this game. You said on the last podcast that you can't see any Canadian MLS players moving to Europe this summer. Wouldn't it make sense for both TFC and Jaden Nelson to find a move for him now before his playoff time is taken by a certain Italian international? TFC has depth at left wing. Mike Lefebvre also asked a similar question. Has Jaden Nelson finally turned the corner? Still young, but he's shown more and more flashes of the player lots expected him to be. A little more polish on his finishing is next. Europe moves soon. So, AGR, you watched him in the flesh. I thought he was pretty good. This is probably his most consistent game he has played. Was it perfect? No, there was still the odd, hesitant decision to be made, but certainly a lot more incisive compared to recent weeks. And Bob Bradley's patience is starting to pay off with him.
Yeah, I mean, when he wants to be, he can take over games now. He has that ability, I think. Before, when he first came in MLS, I think back when he was a 17-year-old under Greg Vanney at the back end of 2020, he was, you know, he filled a role. He'd come on the pitch, you'd notice him there, sort of, but he just would kind of go through the motions and just try to be a safe player. But I think what we're seeing now is he wants to take guys on. He wants to make things happen. He's making dangerous runs. And I think it's for him, I think it's all going to be about building that up and putting the consistency together, because once he does, teams in Europe are going to love that. They love those sorts of, you know, wingers who can turn games on his head. And I think as we've seen with some of his goals this year and some of his moments, like when Jaden Nelson wants to, he can take over games. And I think that's just the part of a young winger, is finding out how to do that every game or for as much of a game as possible. Obviously TFC are, you know, are putting a lot of faith in him. And I like that. And I think big things are coming for Jaden Nelson. I think it's too soon maybe for a move to Europe, just because right at the stage where he's at now, I think of a lot of young wingers, maybe off the top of my head, a guy like a Tejon Buchanan, you know, someone who's figuring that out. And then after a year or two, he really, you know, exploded onto the scene. I think Jaden Nelson does have a lot of those qualities that a guy like a Tejon Buchanan has on the wing. There's the way he attacks guys and can play on both sides. And I think there's no reason to stop that growth while it's going on and pay off for TFC long-term. I mean, yes, there's the whole Lorenzo Insigne question. And it's just like, it kind of shows why this Lorenzo Insigne move is so awkward. And in many senses, of course, he's going to be a fantastic player. But you look at some of the other areas in the squad, You do wonder about what, you know, if that money could have gone elsewhere, especially you see how Jay Nelson is, but hopefully they continue to stick with him, because I think it will pay off in the long term.
And he did trial in Europe before this season, so he does have some connections there. We'll see what transpires. Quickly on Thomas Hassall, who did have a pretty eventful game. Any update yet on his status after he came off injured?
For now, it just looks like some sort of finger injury. From those at field level, it was basically, it wasn't hanging right. Let's just say his finger, from what people saw. So it's, the question is that a dislocation? Because that, in that case, it's a lot shorter term. You pop it in maybe a couple of weeks on the sideline, just because for goalkeepers, any normal finger injury, it takes a little extra time. We saw that with Max Crepeau when he broke his thumb and he was out for a long time. So hopefully, I guess, in the case you're hoping for a dislocation, if not, there is also a possibility it is a fracture or a broken finger. In that case, it's a lot longer term. But from what it sounds like, they were icing it down. They put it in a splinter after the game. And so they're figuring out, you know, going through scans. There are so other than that, it's hard to say, you know, which of the two will be. I think either way, at least a week or two out for him. And hopefully it's something a little more short term, like a dislocation. But let's just say it wasn't hanging right at the field level.
Wasn't play acting after all, was he, Thomas Hassall? In the CPL, York United edged Forge 1-0. Cavalry shut out FC Edmonton 3-0 in El Clasico. Valor and Halifax Wanderers play to a 0-0 draw. And Pacific stayed hot thanks to a 1-0 win over Atletico Ottawa. A couple questions for you here, Alex. Andrew Thompson asked Kunle Dadaluk to the Whitecaps. He's a standout right now in the CPL. He was actually one of your players to watch from a couple weeks ago, and he is living up to that status.
Yeah, I think Kunle Dadaluk, I'd love to see him make a leap up to the Whitecaps or to another MLS team, a right wing. You know, I could, for example, the Whitecaps as a right back or right wing back. He's played as a right back for Pacific. He's just so dangerous in the attack. Like, he's got the speed, but he's also got, you know, just the way he reads the overlaps into the final third. Sometimes he underlaps, sometimes he overlaps, and then he combines that with his speed and also just his strength, which for a guy that fast, just, it's remarkable how he'll blow past guys, just stick out an arm and not lose balance. So I think he has all the attributes to certainly play up a level, especially on the physical. And also, as we're starting to see on the mental side, again, the way he's reading the game, the way he's fit seamlessly into a solid Pacific system. I think there's a lot to like with Kunle Dadaluk's game. And I think long-term, he's a guy who has a lot of MLS upside, if not maybe even at a higher level.
Andrew Thompson also asked about Rocco Romeo. He says that he's been watching him with Valor and seeing major strides in his game. Definitely an area of improvement for the CanMNT. Thoughts on his game and next steps? Based on what I've seen, Alex, like, he's pretty much picking up where he left off when he was on loan in Denmark, in that he's an athletic center back, comfortable enough on the ball. Just maybe his one issue was rushing too many decisions and or just trying to almost act too incisive, if that makes sense. But it seems like he's kind of gotten a cooler head with Valor.
Yeah, I just think for him, it's all about getting reps. I think especially as a young center back, a little, you know, it's hard to get integrated in. But I thought, you know, when Rocco Romeo, especially on his first go around with Valor, I thought he you know, he was someone that had his flashes. And I think just as a young center back, the next thing is to continue to grow from that. He is a tall body, you know, it's coming in at, you know, I think it's above 6'3", 6'4", if I'm not mistaken. Like, he is a big guy and he's getting used to use that frame. And I think based on what we've seen for Valor, it's unfortunate Andre Jean-Baptiste is out, because I'd love to see him learn off a guy like AJB, who's been fantastic whenever he's been healthy in the CPL. But I think Romeo, good things are coming from long term. I think, like you mentioned, Peter, overall, just, you know, his passing is getting there. It's you know, how he uses his size, he is decent in the air, et cetera, et cetera. It's just about getting reps in and really growing those sides of the game and being an everyday center back, which takes time. It's a position where you peak a little later than usual.
Exactly. And to close out the domestic section as well as the show overall, I'm going to close out with a little bit of heat here. The Canadian Championship does start up this week. We discussed our matchups to watch last week, and just because the games will be played on Tuesday when the podcast gets released, it wouldn't make a lot of sense to go too in-depth on everything, but here are the games as a reminder. Guelph United hosts Halifax Wanderers. Atletico Ottawa welcomes York United in an all-Ontario clash, and FC Edmonton takes on Cavalry in another El Clasico. Those are the Tuesday games. On Wednesday, it's Forge welcoming Outremont from the PLSQ. And then the big one, Valor versus Vancouver. So, AGR, we'll close out with this. Matt Chalmers asked, could this be the year that the Whitecaps finally take down a CPL opponent? Your predictions on Twitter earlier indicate that this might be the case, but with a bit of a twist.
I think this is the year they should. I think it's just lined up for them. They're finally finding some form, getting some bodies back at home, BC Place. And, you know, while obviously those things didn't mean anything the last two times the Whitecaps played CPL teams, you know, the first time, obviously, they had a chance at home against Calgary. The second time, they were in great form before heading over to the island to play Pacific. I just think there's too much, you know, going for them right now against Valor, especially now you hear this news this week that obviously Jean-Baptiste is still out. But the big one is that Jonathan Sirois, due to a loan clause in his contract, I'm not confirmed what it is, but based on what I'm reading, it sounds like it's probably to keep him eligible just in case Montreal needs to recall him, given on the fact they're very thin in the goalkeeping department. I think because their trial for Matthew Nogueira fell through. They did sign a third goalkeeper, but things are thin there. So they want to keep Sirois eligible. That's great news for the Whitecaps, the fact they don't have to face him. So I think with the Whitecaps in that sense, you look at Valor as well, just coming off a bye week before a nil-nil draw at home to Halifax Wanderers. And the fact that they have to travel, the Whitecaps don't. Like, the Whitecaps would have to win that game. Long-term, it's going to be hard because they win that. You likely play Cavalry next away in Alberta, unless Edmonton pulls off a miracle. And then even if you get through that, you know, you get to play likely Pacific or York or Ottawa, I mean, at home, which is a bonus. But if it's Pacific, for example, that's not going to be an easy game. So I think for the Whitecaps, at a certain point, there's so many stumbling blocks that if I were going to put money on it, I wouldn't bet on them getting past that Cavalry second round. And that's what I predicted. But of course, it's lined up perfectly for them. If things go right, if they play as they should be going to the final easily. But knowing the Whitecaps, if I'm going to put money where my mouth is, I say they break the slump, but they don't get much further than that second round.
So Phil Dos Santos will not get his redemption, unfortunately, according to AGR. Should be a fun one, though, for sure. That is going to do it for us this week. Thank you, everybody, once again for listening. Before we bow out, just a quick happy belated birthday to our very own Alexander Gonge-Ruzic. Feliz dia to you, mi cuico. The only some of us will know what that means, but that's okay. So for Alexander Gonge-Ruzic and for the currently not here Thomas Neff, I'm Peter Galindo, and we will see you next week.